Hello and welcome to the Blind Shots Podcast. I'm your host, David Hill, coming to you from the 8th green at Park Mammoth Golf Club, having just spent the last 20 minutes hitting putts and chips to different possible pin positions on this green and laughing and having a ball doing it. And this is Season 5, Episode 13. As most of you should know by now, I'm an unapologetic fan of Park Mammoth Golf Club down in Park City, Kentucky. A total redesign crafted by architects Brian Ross and Colton Craig. It's the most exciting new course to hit Kentucky in 15 years, and this past weekend it celebrated its second birthday. Now, for me, Little League and family commitments prevented me from visiting to share in the celebrations, but instead I was rejoined for today's show by the aforementioned Brian Ross to reflect on what he's learned in the years since the Park Mammoth project began, what's still to come for the course, and what else he's seen and doing in the world of golf course architecture and construction writ large. Brian is truly one of my favorite people in golf. He's thoughtful and smart and committed to doing things and treating people the right way. So I feel very fortunate that he makes himself available to chat on days like this. At times, the audio was a bit of a challenge, but the conversation is fantastic, so stick around. Before we dive in, a reminder that the Blind Shots podcast is made possible without commercial interruption or the influence of illicit drugs or alcohol by my day job as David Hill Realtor with Rector Hayden Realtors. I help people sell houses and find their new homes, as well as helping businesses and investors with their commercial property needs here in Central Kentucky. Spring season is here. There's been a marked uptick in activity in the residential market locally, especially among first-time home buyers. So if you have a need or even just have some real estate questions, please reach out. You can email me at davidhill@rhr.com or call me at 859-333-4517, and I'd be happy to start a conversation with you. Now, with that out of the way, here's our conversation about Park Mammoth, golf course architecture, and golf construction trends generally, with Brian Ross. So I was down at Park Mammoth this weekend. I met our friend Jeff from Monsters and Munis, mm-hmm. and Monsters. Also, a gentleman, Jeff from Cincinnati, came down. A man whose only ace is an albatross. That's his claim to fame. He's made that his online persona, which is a nice one. Mm-hmm. And then Mike Forbes out of Canada, via Nashville. He runs a golf app. Kind of does a catalog, of course. He's a very nice guy. Everybody was. They were two first timers. Loved the course. Very impressed. And they were. I think they were kind of interested that the course was actually 2 years old. So congrats on that. The course has made it.
Yeah.
Most new businesses don't make it a year, although golf courses maybe a little less. Talk to me a little bit, just for people that may not remember. That's in the fall of 2019 or early 2020, you land that job as a bunker renovation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now we're getting to
a bunker addition. Yes. So this would have been January 2020.
Okay. Right before the world got real squirrely. Mm-hmm. And it's gone from a bunker addition to the top public course in Kentucky with lots of acclaim. I mean, it really is kind of a rising star in the Mid-South golf scene. So talk to me a little bit about that journey, how that evolution happened.
Yeah. So back to, I guess, the very beginning, you know, that there was a golf course there. It was pretty good golf course. I think it was, you know, condition wise, wasn't up to par. And it had gone through a couple of ownership changes and gone into bankruptcy. And Mr. Chandler and a small group of his friends purchased that property in late 2019. We were brought in to just kind of take a look at it. We were talking about doing some tree clearing, adding some bunkers. Before, there were no bunkers at all on the course before. And rebuilding three greens, and for the most part, the greens were just small ovals, you know, a lot of pitch from back to front, really thick thatch. I mean, it hadn't been given the resources to be a successful golf course. And Mr. Chandler came in and changed that. And during the course of construction, we hadn't been started for a month, and we went right into it. I mean, from being hired in January, we were cutting trees in January. We were moving dirt in March. I mean, the whole thing happened very quickly. It was not a typical planning process, you know, that could potentially be, you know, 12 to 18 months typically. We were less than 2 months. So We kind of just dove right into it and figured it out as we went, essentially. And early on in the process, we made the decision to take a comprehensive look at everything and to look at the greens. And of course, I was a big proponent of that approach, and I had told him before, if I were doing anything, I would fix the greens. Don't worry about bunkers. And, if you got a good set of greens, that can overcome a lot of things. And so once we kind of did that, that let us do some routing changes. It kind of opened up the possibilities to make what was a pretty good golf course, or at least a pretty good site with a good routing. We could make that into a very good golf course. And fortunately and unfortunately, I suppose, with that being the COVID year, I had a couple of other projects that were going to be pulling me away from Park Mammoth a little bit during the summer of 2020. And those went away very quickly on that one day in March when everything kind of shut down. The basketball tournaments all got canceled I lost two projects that day, and so Park Mammoth was the only one I had left. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, man, if he cancels this project, I might have made my last dollar this year. And he came out the next day and was like, so I hear they're shutting everything down. He's like, good news is, I own some hotels in town, so I have the keys. And I own some restaurants in town, so I can keep you guys fed. He's like, if you'll stick on, he's like, we'll keep pushing. And that was, it was such a good thing to hear in that really unsettling time. So we powered through it. I think I spent 220 days on site that year.
That's an eternity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it was like every single day, almost my longest stretch of working every day, 18 straight days working typically like 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. That was really like my life that summer was Park Mammoth. And I think it shows in the result. And since then, so we worked on it in 2020, didn't quite get done. We got all the greens done, got all the bunkers and all that shape, most of the shaping done, but we weren't quite there on grassing yet. So we came back in 2021, finished that all up, and opened in April 28th, 2022. So you're right. Yeah, this week will be the 2-year anniversary, and everything, like you said, it's been kind of a rising star, not meteoric rise certainly, but I think, the word is getting out, especially in some of the larger adjacent cities, Louisville, Lexington, Nashville, Indianapolis, even get quite a few people coming down from there. It's definitely becoming a stop on I-65.
It is. And, it's because it's interesting. Everybody gets kind of impressed by something different, but I remember talking to you and Colton about the project early on for the McKellar article, and kind of a lot of your goals for the course itself have really come to be fulfilled. Now, there have been, I'll get you to talk a little bit about how a golf course evolves and the architects stay involved, but it has been a place that is playable. I can take my kids that are age 9 and 6, stick a tee somewhere in the fairway and play to those greens, and we just have a blast. We did that. We had a warm day on President's Day, a school holiday, and we went down. My 6-year-old still laughs about the 13 he made on number 8. It was hitting some good shots. He got stuck in that back bunker, hit a great bunker shot that just trickled about 3 revolutions too far down, and then he just kind of sunk his head and then just laughed and hit his way back up. So to get around it is pretty easy. To score can be challenging, which, was kind of the mandate, the high on the fun factor, but it was, from a player's perspective, a nice balance of challenge and fun. I mentioned I was down there with a couple of buddies this weekend, and we came to, 14, and I said, okay, here's the last quote unquote boring hole, the palate cleanser. And they stuck that pin right in the middle of the green, and it was an easy 3-putt for everybody. It's there are details there that really come through. The amount of time that you spent there really come through. Let me ask you this: of the looking back at 2 years of the golf course being open, what are you proudest of either the feedback that you've got or just kind of the way it's evolved? Is there something that grabs you that maybe was a detail or something that you had a hand in that you really it's, or is it just that it's still here in 2 years and thriving?
Yeah. And I think you sort of briefly mentioned earlier, you know, with golf, you know, golf courses are typically going to last more than 2 years. You know, if someone's going to invest the amount of money that you have to put in to open a golf facility, you know, that typically you're going to have at least enough money to run that place for a few years and get things sorted out. So it's not so much that it's still there. It's just, for me, it's really just the feedback that it's been getting. It's just so consistently across the board, all the things that we wanted to hit on. You know, we knew we weren't going to have a 7,000 yard course. We weren't going to be challenging tour players. You know, the course record's a 58 already. I mean, someone, it can be gotten, you know, right, even with all the interest in the fun and the greens. If you're out there and you've got a wedge in your hand pretty frequently on approaches, and if your game's really on that day, you can go shoot a number out there. But at the same time, you know, like you mentioned, the guy who shot 58 and then your son, you know, everyone across the board is still leaving there saying like, man, what a fun round of golf. And that was really our goal. And that was Mr. Chandler's primary goal. He told us early on, he's like, I'm not going to be out here questioning every little decision you make. You know, we didn't have free reign, certainly, but we did have the ability to kind of to put some ideas that we had and, you know, kind of deeper in our heads to use out there that maybe we wouldn't have been able to get away with at a private club or somewhere like that. And so, yeah, just the fun factor about it. I think that everyone kind of walks out of there and they want to play it again. They want to come back. They want to tell their friends about it. You know, that's kind of how you grow something and grow a business. And I think they're starting to see the rewards for that this year.
They are, you know, when the clubhouse comes online, that's looking, you know, that I would assume you're getting close to being done with your infrastructure, your mm-hmm. major stuff up there, which is, you know, that's exciting because I think where that's sited is going to be really cool. It's going to be a great viewing, kind of the hangout experience, which is, you know, mm-hmm. I know Mr. Chandler is a big fan of Sweetens Cove, and that's the biggest thing about Sweetens is the vibe and hanging out. And I think, you know, Park Mammoth is set up for success on that. So we've done all the superlatives. Let me hit you with this one. What surprised you, or what was the hardest lesson learned out of the whole Park Mammoth process 2 years, looking back on course being open 2 years and around for almost four?
I guess a tough question. I think there's a few things. I think for me, the big thing is making sure, you know, again, we sort of had a very quick planning process on that. And so we maybe didn't have the full picture of the site when we started, you know, and
sinkholes, you
know, sinkholes, but just everything underground. You know, there's a lot of rock, there's rock shelves out there in places where you wouldn't think. And then there's places where you think there would be rock where there wasn't. And so it was kind of a guessing game on some things. And we definitely had to tweak a few things here and there to adjust to what we were finding underground. And I think if we, you know, had a little bit longer planning period, we would have been able to sort some of those things out. And of course, you know, with us at the time, you know, being our kind of first big project, we were probably a little ambitious on things like timelines and how long we thought things would take, you know, and we had this kind of ideal world scenario where, you know, it takes this long to build a green, this long to build a bunker, we'll have no problem getting this project done, you know, in 2020. And so maybe just from that project, I've kind of learned to like tone some of those things back and be like, okay, you know, here's best case scenario, but here's more likely scenario, on timelines and things like that. So that was a big learning thing for me. It was just, you know, managing a project that scope. You know, when I would work for a contractor, we'd certainly manage some big high value projects, but never run anything, you know, to that scale and that, you know, and the way we did things too, where it wasn't just, we didn't just have one big contractor over the whole thing who was kind of managing all that. It was us. We were the ones kind of putting this thing together, at us and Mr. Chandler and his team. And, you know, at one point in one day out there, we had 30 different companies represented on that golf course, whether it was, you know, sod companies or people laying the sod or people doing drainage and, you know, multiple golf course contractors, irrigation installers. I mean, it was just a they had a couple of local dirt movers. It was just a really, you know, and trying to manage all those different people and different companies and all their personalities, you know, learning how to do that and do that efficiently and keep everyone happy and on the same page is a real, it was a real eye opener for me.
It was, I mean, I made a couple of site visits during construction, and when they were pulling rock out of there to get either drainage or irrigation in there, I mean, it was amazing. The three ring circus that was running, you know, and initially, I guess you guys worked front nine, and then, but once you had front nine and back nine going, I mean, that's a 110 acre construction site. That's nothing. That's a massive, like, logistics nightmare.
And funny is we actually started on the back nine because typically, you know, in a project, you would try to start in a corner somewhere and work yourself out. And so for us, we're like, okay, so we started out on number 12 and we were going to do 12 and 15 and 16 and kind of work back toward the low end of the course. But then, you know, our irrigation pond at the time was going to be up in that area. And then we moved that off the course to the complete other end of the property. And so then from an irrigation perspective, it made more sense. So we needed to be coming from the south, not from the north. And so then we flipped it and moved down and started on number 3, number 7, first two greens we built, and then kind of worked counter to how you would typically do things and work back uphill.
You guys mentioned that at the time you broke a lot of conventions with Park Mammoth. So that doesn't surprise me that you, you didn't paint yourself in a corner, but you had to, you know, just do everything different. Is that the, you know, the project management and the managing relationships, is that the big token you carry with you out of Park Mammoth versus maybe something you found creatively? Because I assume the creative stuff, the fun stuff is kind of inherent. That's what you've learned. That's what you've studied. You know.
Well, especially there, because that was our first chance to put a lot of that into action. You know, we have, you know, it's kind of like, you know, there's a saying in music that you have your whole life to write your first album and then you have 18 months to write your next one. And in today's time, it might be even less than that. You know, you need to be putting out an album a year at this point to stay relevant. And so in golf, it's kind of the same situation. You know, I had 37 years to come up with all those thoughts for my first golf course. And so there were a lot of them up there. And there was, you know, number 8 is obviously one of those examples of a green that I had somewhere, you know, deep in a recess of my mind, and it seemed to fit the land that was there. And so we just kind of went for it. It's certainly a unique green. It's a fun green, challenging, but it's one of those things where it's, you know, I wouldn't have been able to draw that on paper. It had to come out in the field while we were in action. And, you know, from that, so, you know, from that, there's still plenty of ideas that I have in my head and things I want to execute, maybe things I would do a little bit different, but yeah, definitely the managing of expectations and managing of people, obviously that changes from project to project. You know, you learn how to do it. You learn how to be better at it. I'm certainly better at it now than I was in 2020. But the ideas are still all there, and it all goes back to, you know, whatever your design philosophy is and your methodology for getting it done. Those things don't waver. And as long as, you know, you set those goals and you have a client who's aligned with those goals like we had, then, you know, that part's going to sell itself. That's going to take care of itself.
You know, I mentioned your firm, Brian Ross Golf Architects, at some point this year turns 5, which is congratulations. You know, that the golf courses may be heavily capitalized and last past a year, but there's a lot of small businesses that don't. So that's no small accomplishment. Talk to me a little bit about kind of what that journey has been for you. So you have projects that disappear, you know, you come online right before the world falls in on itself. I had a similar experience in 08. I had hair, my beard had color in it. You know, those were good. Those were good times. Days. Right. But you know, now you are busy, which is good. I think you're an associate with the ASGCA now. Is that correct? Which is, you know, again, congrats. So just from the business and the industry side, talk to me a little bit about kind of what your journey has been since, you've decided to take that plunge.
Yeah. Well, like I mentioned, you know, so Park Mammoth was early on in my career. I'd been in business for 8 months when we got that project. And, you know, what a godsend that was. When you think about it from that perspective, I mean, it really pushed me to the next level quicker. And, you know, but one of the things another one of those, I guess, challenges professionally was all the time that I spent on site in 2020. And obviously, you know, with everything going on outside of that, I was spending no time traveling and looking for 2021's project or 2022's, as it turns out. And so that was something that made me kind of rethink how I do things and making sure I'm putting enough focus on not just the work I have right now, because that's obviously the most important of the people, the clients you do have, the people who are paying you right now. You know, you've got to do well for them or nothing else matters. But at the same time, you still have to get that next project for the next year. And so making sure I'm focused on, you know, drawing future business as well. And, you know, your current work can certainly do that. Park Mammoth has gotten me additional work since then. You know, it took a little bit longer, I think, than I'd hoped. I'd kind of hoped, you know, this thing's going to open in April 2022 and my phone's going to start ringing that day when people start seeing it and hearing about it. And, you know, it takes a little bit longer sometimes for that groundswell. And right now, we're really just starting to capitalize on it in 2024. You know, certainly there's no doubt in my mind I wouldn't have gotten the Jekyll Island project with Jeff Stein without Park Mammoth. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And so it is paying off now. And another one of those kind of lessons I've learned is just about patience and, you know, keep doing good work. It's going to pay off. You know, you might not be getting it like right this second, but, you know, keep driving, keep working hard, keep doing good work. And all of a sudden, you know, as Park Mammoth matures and gets a little bit older and more eyes get on it, it starts to get a little more recognition, hopefully, you know, then you'll start getting things from that. But I wanted it right away. And I was, you know, very frustrated in late 2022, because I'd been back at Park Mammoth and we did the driving range. So it felt like, you know, we're making this place better even still, and still not really getting much out of it. But then really, like, you know, the first couple of months of 2023, things really started to change and took off for me. So right now I've got 5 active projects and that is exactly the number I need. I don't think I could do number 6 right now. So, you know, definitely. Yeah,
you'd be hiring associates if you get too busy, right?
I would. And that's something, you know, I've certainly considered already. And
internships, that's the way to go.
Internships, and then, you know, kind of the dope hands model is, you know, people, guys I've always looked up to and tried to focus my company in the way they do things. And, you know, those guys have associates, but they're not full-time employees. They're not W-2 guys. So, you know, being able to build a team and work with other architects who align with me and who do things like I do, who, you know, I can help them if I'm not busy and they can help me if they're not busy. And certainly trying to, you know, to focus on building those type of relationships as well. Guys who, you know, who can help me and I can help them. You know, as we all kind of, we're all in this together in this kind of small niche market, and making sure that we take advantage of all of those resources too.
Well, that's a perfect segue, because my next note, you know, you're going to end up with a bad reputation for really being able to work well with others. I mean, you've got a project with Nate, you've got a project with friend of the podcast, Nathan mm-hmm. Grace. Mm-hmm. I know you have worked with, you've got a relationship with Jaeger. Up mm-hmm. in the Northeast, you've got a project you mentioned with Jeff Stein down on Jekyll mm-hmm. Island. My buddy Scott Lafine and you are teamed up to work here in Kentucky some.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Talk to me. Is there, you know, a lot of guys in the industry, and some of them, there are giant egos around, just like any industry. You know, there are sharks mm-hmm. in my fields. But is there something about your process or just the personalities of the guys that you find that you can collaborate and kind of figure out the yin and the yang of responsibility and boundaries and creativity? Because it's impressive that, you know, you're not just kind of a one trick pony that, you know, you look at the history of golf and there are some great relationships, great partnerships. You know, you think mm-hmm. of McKenzie and Rayner and Banks and all these people that, you know, collaborated. The Philadelphia group famously was kind of a one hit all star deal. But I, you know, it seems like you're exposing yourself to a lot more collaboration, which is, I tip my cap to you. It's great. But is there something, what have you found working with all these other guys that lets you do that or keep getting invited to the party?
Yeah, that's certainly something philosophically that I've always believed in. I think, you know, even though golf's is kind of an individual sport, I've always been a team sport guy. I think that any project, if you can have two creative minds on it, that project's going to be better than if you just have one. And I think history is certainly full of that. You know, you mentioned some of the partnerships, whether it's McDonald Rainer or
Weathered Simpson,
Lanford Moreau, but there's certainly been plenty of those examples, and even up through World War II, things got a little bit after that. It was a little more okay. Well, here's the guy with his name on the door, and he might have some associates, and Ross was certainly that way, as a bit of a standoff. But by the same token, those guys were all friendly too, and A.W. Tillinghast and Walter Travis used to go down to Pinehurst and stay at Ross's house with him. And both of those guys claim parts of what happened on Pinehurst number two, for example. Yep. They offered input on those projects. And so those guys all got along as well. And again, it was a small group of guys who were building the golf courses in the U.S. in the 1910s and 20s. And I think it's really not that much different today. And so if I can take, a relationship that I have, and I'm always just looking for people that I can get along with first, people that either I enjoy spending time with at events and golf shows and trade shows and things like that, but also, what are those guys' priorities professionally? What are they, what's their design philosophy? What's their, how do they go about operating their companies? And when you can find people like that, that you align with on multiple things, you get along with them because you're going to be spending time with them off the golf course too. And then, do their values for golf, do they see golf in the way that I do? And if you can put those two things together, then, there's no doubt in my mind, 100% guarantee that project's going to be better with both of you on there than it would be with just one of you. So again, I'm always looking for those types of things, and then it has to make sense in other ways too, with Scott being there in Cincinnati, and he's a rising architect who's kind of starting to look for work on his own as well. He's primarily worked for other people up till now, and I felt like there's no doubt, having Scott on my team, partnering with Scott on this project is going to help us get this work, and Scott and I get along very well, and so I knew that project is going to go well. I'm certain of it because Scott's there too, and he's right there in town. So, professionally it made sense as well. Certainly with Jeff and I get along great. I mean, he's probably my best friend in the industry as well as extremely talented golf architect, extraordinarily talented shaper. We definitely see eye to eye. We're both golden age aficionados. We built our companies in the same way, about the same time frame. My work at Park Mammoth, he being on site at Hoopy for the entirety of that project, those two reasons are the main reason that we got that project over some guys who've been in the industry a lot longer than we have. And so, just being able to know when you're putting something together, is this going to help us? First of all, is it going to help us get the project? Because if you don't get the project, you're not going to be collaborating with that guy, at least not there. So, I think I'm pretty good at being able to identify those things as well. And knowing that, this person may be a fit here. This person may be a fit there. Nathan and Todd reached out to me at Starkey Park, on the alternative, right? Typically, I've been the one putting these teams together and they reached out to me on that one. And I was semi-local kind of in the area and they were both, looking to expand a little bit, expand their reach. And, Nathan was certainly trying to get into Texas. And, he is a really fun guy to be around. Todd is too. I mean, three of us together, just a big crackpot of jokes and laughs. And, but they're also, they're really talented architects and they work a little bit different than I do, but that project still, you know, I think it made sense for me at the time. And again, no doubt that those projects make us better. And to be honest, what it really boils down to is like, I couldn't have five projects right now just by myself. There's just no possible way. And especially with them kind of all being in planning at the same time. And now this year and next year will all be kind of under construction at the same time. So, you know, again, being able to kind of swallow your pride a little bit and be like, okay, well, I'm making a little bit less money, but I can do a little bit more work, or I can be in two places instead of just one right now. And so again, those being able to kind of identify those relationships and choose the right people to work with on the right projects. And you know, I don't want to get the reputation where like I'm always working with someone different. You know, I'd like to have a smaller group of guys who collaborate with me. I don't want to necessarily collaborate with every architect in the industry. But, you know, making sure that the ones that I am collaborating with, that we share vision, that I think it's going to make that project better. And so again, that's just something I'm kind of always looking for.
You know, that's, I love that you and Nathan are together, because you both kind of came up through the PGA, the operations side, and then mm-hmm. found, you know, got into your eventual passion. Well, one of the things that you don't have a partner on that is a Brian Ross original was just announced was the Boneyard down at Park Mammoth, mm-hmm. which I am excited about. Having been there twice, it's taken all of my willpower and restraint not to just go hiking up to see where you've staked everything.
You should have gone. You should have gone.
There may be another chance, but I want to, you know, our friend Mike Young over in Georgia, mm-hmm. who I have become very fond of, because he mm-hmm. can form an opinion about anything, which is just he's just fantastic.
Yeah, he's great.
One of his hobby horses to beat on is that, you know, there are full jacket wearing members of the alphabet soup of the ASGCA that have never routed a golf course, and he kind of mm-hmm. snides and snickers. Is this is the Boneyard your first chance to kind of model the clay from the beginning to have a raw site and route it, or have you done routings on some of these other projects?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, I you know, Park Mammoth was.
You were in a footprint. Yeah, you built a new golf course.
We were in a footprint, but we really, you know, we moved tees, center lines, fairways everywhere, but yeah, I guess this would be the first. I mean, at Jekyll Island, we had an 18-hole Dick Wilson course there that we could figure out a new 9-hole routing.
Right.
Basically, we were building 9 new holes on an 18-hole course, but that had to connect.
I just wasn't sure the timing on those. Yeah, because the Jekyll Island project
is radical. We did do Jekyll first. What I will say, though, is that, you know, Jeff and I both took a stab at that routing separately. We wanted to kind of do one, compare notes, see where we were. We did the exact same thing. And it's not tremendously different from Dick Wilson's routing either. So does that count? I think it counts, because we did go through the exercise, you know, and what we determined was, you know, there's really one way to get from the clubhouse out to the Travis holes, play the Travis holes, and then get back. The one route that makes sense. And we wanted it to be tight. We wanted the greens to be close to the tees. We don't want it to feel like a golf course, because the Travis course wasn't.
Right.
And so we kind of both ended up in the same place on that. So, you know, maybe that counts. I tell people, you know, who are kind of lamenting the loss of the Wilson course there, I'm like, well, you know, you're going to go out there and you're going to play these 9 new holes that Jeff and I are doing that are going to be kind of Walter Travis inspired. And they're our holes. But I think if you've played out there before and you like the Oleander course, you'll remember the routing. It's not that much different. So again, you know, that's kind of a similar situation to what happened to Park Mammoth as well. But yes, certainly in terms of being raw land and getting to choose the tee and green locations, this is the first opportunity to do that. And obviously it's not, you know, it's not a full length golf course. I'm not putting fairway bunkers and, you know, putting par threes with par fours and par fives. So it's a little bit different. I suppose I would say I'm looking for that opportunity to actually do, you know, a full golf course routing, whether it's 9 or 18 or the amount of holes don't matter so much as just being able to kind of piece those things together and figure out, you know, well, okay, so this area makes sense for a par 3, but here's, you know, how do I get to the next hole that I want to build? And, you know, what's the connection? And, you know, is it a par 4? Is it a par 5? What orientation does it play? Still haven't had that chance, but yes, you know, very excited about the Boneyard. It's going to be a lot of fun. Obviously, appreciative of Mr. Chandler and his continued investment in Park Mammoth. They're not just resting on their laurels there. We're going to go out and continue to improve that facility. You know, you mentioned earlier the clubhouse, going to open that thing up in June or July this year. Having that food and beverage option and having a place where people can hang out after the round. You know, what I've always preached to him, and you know, I certainly have no ownership stake in this place, but he does value my opinion, and he knows that I've seen a lot of golf around the world, and I've seen what works and what doesn't work. So he does value my opinion on that, and I've always pushed him toward, you know, you need to give people a reason to come to Park City for the weekend, not just to play it as they're passing through on a golf trip or as they're traveling down 65, and you know, you need to give people a reason to come out here and spend a weekend. So there's plenty to do outside of golf as well with the, you know, with the national park and all the surrounding area. And Bowling Green's a great town, but it's still 30 minutes away. And so if you're going to, you know, have people staying at your hotels there and you're transporting them out to the golf course, like, yeah, that's fun, but it's not quite that golf trip mentality where you get out and kind of embrace a site for a weekend and, like, you know, like the camping experience more. And so we're going to keep pushing forward that and, you know, giving people a reason to stick around after the round and play some golf. You know, in addition to the Boneyard and what wasn't really shown or talked about in that routing, I think we're going to build, you know, a very large putting green.
Awesome.
You know, we've got that old, what was going to be the irons only range kind of between holes 1 and 9. Mm-hmm. You know, that spot's just been sitting there for a few years. And since we built the full length range 2022, it's just been, you know, basically just sitting there. They're still mowing it, yep, still having to water it. And so it's not giving them any return on their investment for that portion of the property. So I think we're going to build a big, you know, kind of fun Himalaya style putting green out there with the putting course where, you know, again, you play the 18 hole course, you're going to stick around. You know, that type of thing can be a revenue driver. And so
absolutely,
that will be included in kind of our goals for this year. And then hopefully, you know, moving forward from here, we'll start looking at some options to allow people to not have to go to Bowling Green for the weekend.
You know, I had a conversation yesterday with Kieran Clark over in Scotland. He works for Golf Shake, mm-hmm, digital golf media outlet. And, you know, I take a lot of golf trips, and mm-hmm, where, you know, the thing you're harping on exactly what my guys look for, like the Cradle kind of ruined short courses for us on the pitch and putt a little bit, just cause that's so well done. And the, mm-hmm, you know, it's kind of a machine, although I'm kind of becoming a connoisseur. That's the first thing I check out when I go someplace, but mm-hmm, the putting course, you know, all of the new resorts are putting those in, and that's really a place where you can just go and be. You know, you can grab a, you know, have little drink stands and go around and settle bets. And that's where the big laughs are. That's when you can, mm-hmm, just kind of, you know, you don't have to worry. It's a stress-free golf because nobody, if you shank a putt, everyone just laughs. It's not like, you know, a shot on the regular course. I can take, yeah, my kids out there. You know, everyone I take down there, I have made the point wherever they cut the cup on 8, I go and stand with the flag on the other side of the green and I say, okay, boys, here you go. You know, we tagged you in some video of that.
I saw, yes.
I was down there with some pros last year, and we were kind of on our own within the flow. We might have spent 20 minutes on that green, just hitting putts, mm-hmm, hitting shots out of the bunker. So yes, that watching the ball on the ground is so much, mm-hmm, fun. There's a portion of the golf community that just loves that. And so,
yeah,
you know, a good wild putting course. I'm excited to hear that.
Yeah, well, we certainly, again, we've got the space for it right now. That land's giving us nothing back.
Right.
But it can. And it's also, you know, it can even be an attractant for, you know, for learning golfers too, people who are too afraid to go out and try nine holes of golf, or, you know, to, that maybe you don't even have a full set of clubs, can still go out there and get that golf experience. They can be buying food and drinks at the clubhouse, so they're still driving revenue to the golf course. So to me, if you have the land for it, they're no brainers to me.
I mean, yeah, and you're kind of walking yourself. You're kind of going backwards. You've ended up at the community golf model that is really, I mean, you get people to the course, put a putter in their hand. Once they can putt, mm-hmm. put a wedge in their hand, go play the Boneyard. Once you're proficient at that, progress to the big course, and the mm-hmm. your 18 hole course is just, I mean, the way the greens, you can run the ball onto the green, is just perfect for that. I do want to mm-hmm. get your thoughts on this. Of the 12,000 different thoughts that you have as you're out there walking, trying to find the Boneyard, what were the couple of guiding principles for you? Did you have a mandate? Is it going to resemble the big course, or is it going to, were there marching orders, or was it just go find it? And you invented your own goals for it. Talk to me a little bit about what we're going to find. I'm sure it'll change between now and the time that that grass grows on it.
It certainly will. Right now it's just on paper, and that's about worth what it's printed on thing was used to print it. But I think I wanted it to be a little different. Again, Dave's not one of those people who kind of mandate. He's just like, all right, here's what we want to do. And you know, at first when it started out, it was going to be a par three course, like, you know, 6 iron or less. So maybe holes up to 160 yards. It kind of evolved backward from that, back into more of a short course. I think the more he studied it and looked at other places like the Cradle and like the Hay at Pinehurst, mm-hmm. at Pebble Beach, I think he started to see the value in that instead. And, you know, not having to take a full bag and just being able to carry two or three clubs and go around. And I think he started to kind of see my side of things on that, because I was pushing for a short course since the day we started out there. I thought, you know, it's to me, it's no brainer, like the next step you would take. And so that's kind of where we ended up. You know, he did want to have a set number of holes, you know, that's a little more standard. You know, you see a lot of them today, they're 13 holes or 19 or
right. That's, or 10. That's the mandate at the resort. 10
hole courses. Yeah. So, you know, he did want, you know, nine, because I had a 10 hole routing that made a lot of sense to me. And we ended up kind of, sacrificing one pretty good hole to build nine instead. So that was kind of the one thing, but I wanted it to be a little different. I wanted you to get a little bit different experience, because, you know, the golf course that's in the valley is big and broad and wide, and there are trees on the perimeter, but they aren't really impacting you as you play. We buried all of the rock, buried or hauled off. That's kind of how this golf course got its name in a way, because everyone calls that area that's over there, not directly underneath where we're going to be building, but just adjacent to it, they call it the rock graveyard. And so, you know, to me, you know, the Boneyard just made perfect sense with the mammoth kind of theme mm-hmm. that we've got going out there. And then of course that being the rock graveyard. And I mean, you saw it. A lot of people didn't see it. I think if you look at it on Google Earth, you can sort of see where we took all that rock. And I mean, heck, it was an insane amount of rock. And then we did
the same size of the rock. I mean, these were basically,
right. I mean, we're talking about Cadillac size rocks sometimes. Yeah,
they were going into basically like coal truck size dump trucks. Mm-hmm. And it looked like Tonka. It looked like my kid playing with his Tonka toys in the backyard. The rock was so big. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, when we were building the big course, there was one day when I was out there and they were putting the mainline irrigation in across like 3, 8, and 3 and yeah. number 4. And it looked like something like a World War II bomb scene. I mean, it was just debris everywhere, rock everywhere, all this old pipe there pulling out of the ground. It was just like, oh my gosh, what are we doing? But, we got it in. So anyway, so I want that course to be a little bit of a different experience. I want you to kind of get that experience that is in the hills, right? Because the golf course is all in this valley. And so I wanted you to kind of get the experience, what you see behind number 8 green, right? And so we cleared out all the cedar out of that area behind number 8 on the main course and, you know, exposing all those rock ledges. And I mean, there are some rock ledges up the hill there from the driving range that are, you know, 8 to 10 feet tall, like just beautiful, like really things that should be featured. So for me, I was looking for, like, how do we get from where we're going to start, which we knew was going to be kind of right down by the putting green and the practice area and the driving range tee. You know, how do we get from there up into the mountain a little bit, you know, up into that rock and experience that. And, you know, so that was kind of my primary goal. I was like, all right, I want to get up into that area at least one time. We got to get up to it. Found a really good green site that's kind of right up against that rock ledge. So basically the rock ledge will be right behind the green. And that'll be kind of our third green is basically that. So third green is, you know, a big kind of uphill 100-yard shot. It'll probably be the only hole out there where you can't see the putting green. It's going to be more like number 18 on the main course or
okay,
something like that. But I wanted to kind of have that rock ledge experience behind it. And then I found a nice path up the rock ledge to where we could actually play the fourth hole along that rock ledge. And so this is the kind of the one place where we're actually in the forest where you're going to have trees on both sides of you. You don't really get that much on the main course either. And so, you know, being able to get up into the woods and kind of get that little bit different experience than what you get on the main course was one of my big goals. And then of course you come out of that and you get back down into the field a little bit and play around. And then there's one core area on the course. It's kind of out in the middle where, you know, the second green, the sixth green, the seventh green, eighth tee, third tee, they're all kind of right there together. It's kind of like central gathering point of the site as well. And so, you know, another one of those things that I'm always looking for in any type of golf course, it's like, how do you bring people together or playing different holes? And you always want to look for that crossover point, perhaps, where you go from one green, you walk around the back of another green and just really kind of bringing that community aspect to golf out. And so we were able to find that there. And then of course, you know, obviously trying to get back to the pretty close to where you started. And so we were able to do that as well. And so, you know, the first tee, ninth green, and then we'll have a practice putting green between the two of them over there as well. In addition to the larger putting green, so the larger putting green will be, you know, closer to the clubhouse. But yeah, so that was kind of my goals, you know, try to get people out and give them a little bit different experience here, you know, kind of get that kind of mammoth cave type of experience.
I can just see your Appalachian heart just growing as all this talk of in the hills and the rock ledges.
You
know, I went and visited our friend Brad Reynolds a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. and saw your green down there, and I was shocked and so thrilled with what he and his crew had done with the bunkers. You know, they had mm-hmm. they had sprayed about half of them. They had Billy Bunker, or Better Billy, mm-hmm. coming back, I think, the week after I visited, and just kind of really reinvented the look of that course, which was great, and also served the function of kind of making sure a lot of that rock doesn't come up, at least for a while, through those bunkers, which is something Park Mammoth, I'm sure, you know, you're worried all that rock underneath, is it going to come up through your fairways? It probably eventually will. I mean, it's just the reality. Mm-hmm. You're in cave country. That stuff's always moving. Mm-hmm. You know, this, the Boneyard you've got, it's a solo project. How tempting is it to get all your crazy out again? You know, all those ideas from deep in the recess. Cause I did get invited. I was an add-on to a trip down to Cabot Citrus, mm-hmm. about a month ago. And it looked like, you know, that's Kyle Franz and I forget the other gentleman that's on there, but those greens looked like, oh, they've been redesigning and reinvigorating old courses for so long, man, they really cut loose on some of those greens. It's kind of what it felt mm-hmm. like to me. It may have been the mandate of the place. And they've got a little short course that I went out and played with my 50 degree gap wedge and my putter. And I could play all, I think it was 10 holes for 1,000 yards, which was kind of the gimmick on the scorecard, which was a nice little thing. But it was, you know, that versus the par three, the 9-hole course that you know, had a short par five. And anyway, it was just interesting to see kind of, it looked like maybe they didn't temper a lot of those wild ideas. So are you going to go crazy on this one? You don't have, or are you conscious enough at it 5 years in to kind of doing your own designs that you think you will temper a lot of that, the deepest recess ideas, or is the short course philosophically the place to do that, to try new things?
Yeah, that's actually what I was just about to say. I think the short course is the place to try that. I think, because you have a wedge in your hand and you're hitting from a level surface, you know, when you're on a full size golf course, you know, those center lines don't mean anything to anybody except the scratch player, right? I mean, they're the person that you're turning, where your turning points are in the holes and things like that. Like, they, very few golfers actually play golf that way. You know, you're coming in from the left or the right, or it might be your sixth shot instead of your third. You know, short courses are, they kind of bring everyone back to the same place, right? They give everyone a chance to make a one there, you know? And so I think, you know, as you mentioned earlier, you know, being able to see the ball move on the ground, I like seeing the ball land somewhere and end up somewhere else, and you can kind of track it across the green. Tobacco Road is a great place.
Yes, absolutely.
For that, and, you know, where, you know, the Cradle of Pinehurst is another, where you can kind of hit a shot that lands on the far left side of the green and the pin's on the right, and you can just kind of watch that thing tracking across the green as it goes, if you can get that speed slot. And, you know, so certainly this will be, I would say, potentially even more intriguing than the main course on the greens. I'm definitely going to take some liberties on those, and I've got some pretty good ideas cooking on some things. And you know, just like any golf course I do, there's going to be some inspiration from other places that I've seen, that I, you know, things that I want to kind of put my spin on. And there's a couple of those that I have in mind. But yeah, we definitely won't take it easy on that.
That's exciting. I love it. You know, I play with some guys that some of them get Tobacco Road. Like, that's the way you play. You aim away from the hole and you let it feed down some of those big slopes. And some guys, their brain just can't process that. And I pity them.
The 11th green on the main course is another good example of a green like that. In that vein, you know, it's a very large green on a very short hole where, you know, again, just the day-to-day setup, like, what's going to keep you coming back to the Boneyard and wanting to play it again? And, you know, if it's just kind of vanilla where it's like, okay, yeah, this 100 yards, I'm going to hit my 100-yard club.
Right.
That's it. Now all you got to do is hit the green, you'll make a par. You know, I don't like that. That's not golf to me. I think, you know, hitting the green isn't – the hole's not over.
Right.
At that point to me. So, you know, how do we make it interesting and keep it interesting day to day, where if you do go to Park Mammoth for the weekend, which again is the goal long term, then, you know, what makes you decide to play the Boneyard again the second day?
I'll be playing it multiple times a day. I'm just a short course guy. I want to see that ball on the ground. You know, and the fellas I played with were impressed with 11. You know, they're some pretty high level play, and they you know, and still they couldn't spin the ball and stop it. It was landing and feeding. It was a right side pin. So everybody hit and kind of faded around. I just made sure they weren't short, but I told them the story, the seven deadly sins. They loved that theory that, you know, a wedge in your hand to a 10,000 square foot green and that ball is going to move, and you're just going to manage how it's going to move.
That's right.
I want to turn to a little bit to a little bigger picture issues. You know, you've worked for Mr. Chandler, who's kind of a benevolent, wealthy individual, and this was his, you know, project with his investors. But you've also spent some time in the RFP world of municipal golf. And it's interesting to see, you know, resort golf, destination golf is very hot. I mean, there's lots of restoration work going on. People are, you know, they've got deferred maintenance lists and they're catching up, but it seems like a lot of the new construction is focused on either the destination golf. I wonder, is there anything in between happening that you're seeing from your industry? Are there mom and pop golf courses? Are all the mom and pop kind of suburban or rural golf courses that are ever going to exist, have they already been built? Like, is there a middle market that you're seeing kind of from the golf course building industry, or is it all either really high end or, you know, state and municipal projects that are being reinvested in?
Yeah, unfortunately, I feel like it is. It's high end resort, high end private, or municipal reinvestment right now. Unfortunately, I don't see much of that middle ground. And you know, there's been some interesting conversations I've had with some friends and colleagues in the industry. And I think what it boils down to is just the cost of land and the cost to build a golf course right now just make it very difficult or possibly even unfeasible to build a place like Park Mammoth. and have it succeed and still be affordable. I think that that middle ground, unless you do it yourself, I think that's kind of the only, you know, where it might take 5 years to build it or something like that. And you just, it's a passion project. Like, you know, Park Mammoth was a passion project for Mr. Chandler. I mean, it, without a doubt. If you had a team of investors who were seeking, you know, your typical return on that, like what's going to make them invest in this versus, you know, the market? Why are they going to invest in your golf product? You know, that's not happening on the middle ground. I think the only place it can happen is places like, you know, with what Dream Golf, Kaiser and those guys are doing, or Ben Callender and his Cabot product, or the, you know, obviously the uber high end, you know, six figure initiation fee type places that, you know, a lot of that's going on in Texas and Florida and places like that right now. Those private, you know, uber private facilities.
Aiken.
So that's really all around Aiken, right? And so that's unfortunately all I'm seeing right now. I don't think the middle ground, you know, those mom and pop places, that a lot of those guys are renovating, I think, but they're just doing it in house, or they're just, you know, just kind of rebuilding what was already there. But don't see anything, of course, construction wise in that market.
You know, that was one of the remarkable things. I mentioned Brad up at Stonecrest, that they were able to do a lot of that kind of in-house, bring in obviously the bunker contractor, but that Mr. Talent was able to kind of finance that. But even there, you're talking about a benevolent passion project of.
Absolutely. That was a passion project. Mr. Talent understands, you know, Stonecrest is better, absolutely, than it was 2 years ago. But, you know, there's no guarantee that he's going to make his money back on that project. And I think, you know, he's fully aware and comfortable with that. And if you're not, you know, if this is a project that you're only doing because you want to make money at it, you know, that middle ground market's difficult. It's tough. It's tough anyway. It was tough anyway before, but just with the construction costs, the amount of money you have to spend just on pipe and irrigation heads and that type of stuff, I mean, it's making it really unfeasible to have that middle market, unfortunately.
Yeah, that is disheartening. Yeah, I heard, again, just to mention, I've been down to LaGrange a couple of times, and I heard Mike Field's interview, I guess on the fried egg of one of those. And he said, you know, he ruffled some feathers because he started finding used, a guy developed a market for used heads, you know, reconditioned, kind of refabricated stuff, which was interesting in a way, you know, all the different little cheat codes that an owner could use. Do you have any wisdom or any input on how to sell a municipal body on the idea of a master plan? Because I ask that because I've interviewed the Kentucky State Parks Commissioner about a month ago, and I asked him, you know, what's your process? And he goes, do you have a plan, or is it you get a budget allocation and you just figure out how you're going to spend it? And he goes, completely the latter, because he never knows what the funding allocation out of the Kentucky budget is going to be. So they got a big chunk, and then he got to kind of triage that. Locally, we have a funding the parks initiative here in Lexington, which the golf courses are under the umbrella of Parks and Recreation. So their master plan isn't just for the golf courses. It's, you know, all 108 like parks and park projects that they want to have list. And does golf have golf is entrepreneurial versus the parks, which are just kind of green space and upkeep. And it's really disheartening and mind boggling for kind of a citizen advocate to say, hey, you've got these really nice golf course assets, invest them. Is there, in your dealings with municipal, councils or committees or what, have you had any good experiences, or is that part of our similar haircut that you have an idea, but there's so much red tape to get through? Are you seeing attitudes change within the muni space from the golf course management and ownership side at all?
Yeah, I mean, municipalities will do master planning. You know, Jekyll Island is a great example that I'm familiar with.
Yeah, I think you caught a unicorn there.
Yeah, perhaps. But, you know, they started their planning process in 2013, and they just started construction this year. So, you know, 10-year process of kind of evaluating and studying their golf courses. They started with the National Golf Foundation, which a lot of municipalities do. You know, I kind of follow and try to keep in touch with those guys because, you know, if a municipality is going to do a feasibility study, then that's kind of setting up for a project typically. Not always, of course, but you know, sometimes the NGF will tell them, yeah, you've got too much golf, or you know, that's what they told them at Jekyll Island. You know, you guys have too much golf for this market. You're spending too much money. You're not able, as state park, charge what they can charge people to stay and play at Sea Island. Don't try to compete with those guys. You know, let's downsize a little bit. And that's so they kind of proposed that in their study. Jekyll Island Authority hired Troy Vincent and his team to do a full island golf master plan in 2017, which they completed, and it's finally gotten to a project now in 2023 with the Pine Lakes course, and then with our course starting later this year. So yeah, I mean, it is feasible for sure, but for the most part, I find municipalities are kind of approaching it in a, you know, they know they just need to upgrade. It's just a situationally, like, they just can't rely on the equipment and the things they have anymore. But the last big municipal golf boom was in the 90s and the early 90s. And every one of those courses, or even the older courses that renovated during that time, I mean, that they're at the end.
Now, a brief intermission, thanks to our friendly local electric and cable utility subcontractors. Okay, so there, thank you to Charter Spectrum for, they're doing tree trimming in my neighborhood, which means...
never good.
Right, so this has been an intermittent issue. So this is going to be the most jacked audio file of all time. I'm now pointing a microphone at my phone, which I actually did with Mark Stewart, because he didn't have Skype or Zoom way back in the day when I talked to him about something, which was hilarious. But so you were optimistic that, you know, municipalities will get around to reinvesting with their master plan, which is good.
My view on it is that they are reinvesting, but most municipalities won't or don't go through the master plan process first. They might do it, you know, they might do a National Golf Foundation feasibility study and figure out, you know, a lot of times from that, they'll learn that, okay, you know, maybe we've got a little bit too much golf. Let's look to go from 18 holes to 9 holes here and give some land back for parks, or 36 to 18, or something like that. And in those instances, then they'll hire someone through RFP to do a master plan for that facility. But you don't typically see too many, you know, citywide or statewide or countywide master plans for all their golf courses. Those are typically just, for one thing, you know, as an architect, you don't necessarily want to spend a bunch of time and effort putting a plan together for something that may not ever happen. And so if they don't have the funding in place, which they never do, right, to actually do the work until there's a catalyst, either someone donates some money, or, you know, in Starkey Park's scenario, it was ARP funding. You know, they had $1.5 million that they had kind of set aside from what they got from the Recovery Act, and they were going to use that for new irrigation system. And then, you know, fortunately there was someone in the room was like, well, why don't we actually fix the other things wrong with the golf course at the same time? And so that's what kind of started the ball rolling there. But again, even there, you know, they did an NGF study first, and then they, you know, went out for RFP, where Nathan Todd and I were hired. But, you know, typically you're not going to see too many of those. Like, okay, we're going to hire an architect to do master planning for all four of our golf courses, like what they did in Jekyll Island. That's pretty rare.
Well, that's disheartening, but I'm confident that you're right. The
cities are reinvesting right now. They are, because again, a lot of these places, their taxes are going up, right? You know, property taxes are higher than they used to be almost everywhere in the country, you know, so you're getting some additional income there. Any type of city where people are moving in and out, you know, obviously a lot of people, like Seguin's a good example of a city that's growing right now. They have a new tax base. the people who are moving there are paying more than the people who live there pay for those houses, right? So you got some additional money coming in there that you can kind of allocate and say, okay, you know, we can afford to do this project now, and we need to do this project now.
Well, they run into
counties are in the place where they need to do it, but some of them can't, unfortunately.
And you know, then you bump into my day job where, you know, all of a sudden people are moving and they need more room for houses. And if we can steal 9 holes and make that, you know, affordable housing or something that, you know, because the cost of living has gone up. And that's, I don't want to spin off into that whole thing, but that's a friction that's real and is happening in the popular places where people are moving to and want to. But at the same time, you have a like Lexington, we're trying to pass we've got a ballot initiative to do dedicated parks funding because they don't want to lose the amenities. You know, they want to spread and grow those. So it's weird.
Well, fortunately, it's much more difficult for a municipality to get rid of their land to build homes than it is for, say, just a single owner or an investor group. You know, it does happen, unfortunately, but it doesn't happen with the same frequency where you might lose semi-private or even public golf that's privately owned. You know, it's just, yeah, that you see a lot of conversion from golf to maybe some other park use, but not so much from golf to housing.
Right. There's I'm kind of encouraged that you're seeing these people use the NGF a lot, because there's a consultant based, I think he's based out of Louisville, that goes around, and he's like the Pied Piper for you have too much golf. He just goes around and tells councils to close golf courses, which is, I have issues with. Like, that's just his business model. He's never, I don't think, ever once said, yes, you need to reinvest or change these. It's for an avid golf. Now, granted, not all golf courses are gyms and need to be saved or can be saved, but for, you know, just for people to welcome in somebody with an agenda like that. But that's a whole other, that's my political rant.
That's definitely disappointing. Hopefully it's not, you know, intentional on his part.
Oh, it's absolutely intentional. It's a reaction to the elitism and, you know, the environmental impact, all the perceptions of what's wrong with golf. And he's made it into a little cottage industry. We're not sitting around and taking it anymore, at least not locally. I've taken more of your time than I should have. I'll get you out of here on this one. We started off looking at Park Mammoth at 2 years. I think I kind of know what you've got, but, you know, at Park Mammoth at 10 years, what your best case scenario, what do you hope to see? What conversation are you hoping to have about that place once it gets to its next big birthday, 5 years or 10 years down the road?
I guess I just hope it has staying power. You know, I think you see a lot of things, new builds that people get excited about, and then, you know, 10 years later when there's more new courses being built, those are the ones that everyone's talking about, and those other places get forgotten a little bit. You know, I just hope that what we built up there has staying power, and I think it does, because, again, we'll always be competitive because of the market that it's in. I think that, you know, we're not going to be able to ever charge $200 or $300 for a round. I just don't see it getting to that point. So I think it's always going to be an attractant to people in Nashville and the bigger cities in that area that, hey, you know, we can go and drive 90 minutes or 2 hours like it is for you and play, you know, a really good golf course for less than what we're going to have to pay here locally to play. And so I think it'll have that staying power. I just kind of hope that, you know, the decisions that we're making, you know, that we're right in those, and that I told Ms. Chandler just the other day, in fact, that, you know, when I'm looking to do something, because we were just kind of exploring ideas for what to do with that old driving range. And, you know, I want to make sure, like, you know, even though I don't own this golf course, you know, I still have an ownership in it in a way, because if it's successful, then I'm successful and vice versa. But, you know, making sure that, you know, the things that we're doing are good for the golf course, are good for the longevity of the golf course, and that they're going to be revenue drivers for the golf course. You don't want to build something that's going to be a loser for you personally or for the, you know, for the Park Mammoth brand. And so making sure that, you know, the decisions we're making are in line with kind of market trends and where we see the market going even in the future. And I think certainly that that's where we're headed, I think. So I think, you know, in 10 years, you'll see Park Mammoth as one of those places that, you know, has stayed around, where people do travel to Park Mammoth and stay a weekend there and maybe bring their family and spend a day at Mammoth Cave and, you know, exploring Bowling Green and Central Kentucky. And that's kind of my goal for it. And so, you know, anytime I'm tasked with doing something golf related, I'm making sure that what I'm doing is kind of pushing it in that direction where it's going to have that staying power.
Well said. Well, I'll cut there. Hey, thanks for stopping by for this episode of the Blind Shots Podcast. Brian Ross truly is one of my favorite people in the golf business. I'm so happy for him that he's starting to make and find his way in the business, and that he's working on courses that so many people will have the chance to play, like Park Mammoth. If you haven't been to Park Mammoth Golf Club, and you can at all find an excuse to get to Louisville or Nashville or any points between, go see it. Go play it. I think you're really going to like it. And once the Boneyard is built out and opens up, along with the apparent breaking news of this episode about the soon-to-come putting course, it's going to be a can't-miss destination. Hope you've enjoyed what you've heard here today. If you didn't enjoy it, sorry. I'll try to do better the next time. Until then, drink plenty of water and sit up straight. And when you have the chance, do decide to go for it and take dead aim. I tell you, Lansing was a nice place to get into a knife fight. Like playing, I stopped for gas and food there. Like, holy rust belt, Batman.
It is. It's not. Woo. You know, we put our capital there not because it was the nicest place. It was centrally. that's all right. Hey, it at least it can look down the river at Flint and be like, at least we're not them.
Yeah.